I next met with Dr. Leif Bergsagel to chat about multiple myeloma, and to begin, he commented on carfilzomib, an irreversible proteasome inhibitor just approved by the FDA for relapsed disease.
Carfilzomib is a novel proteasome inhibitor, and it uses a different backbone than bortezomib, and has different characteristics. It's what's called an irreversible proteasome inhibitor. And it seems to have similar activity to bortezomib. It's hard to know if it's better, but certainly it appears that there's some anecdotes that it's active in some patients who have relapsed or were refractory to bortezomib, although the response rate is lower in that setting. Well, I think what's really exciting about carfilzomib is the fact that the side effect profile is very different. You don't see the neuropathy, and that's a big concern for a lot of patients. And there's some exciting data. It's very, very preliminary, but exciting data about the combination of lenalidomide and carfilzomib and dexamethasone showing exceptionally high and deep response rates in the upfront setting. I think it's very premature, and I think more data needs to be made before we can make a conclusion about that.
Have you actually used the drug yourself?
Yeah, we participated in the clinical trials in the phase 1 and the phase 2 setting. And since it's been approved, I've treated patients with it.
Do you think you can sort of discern in your own practice less neuropathy, or is it more from the trial data?
Well, I think it's true that with the use of weekly bortezomib and the use of subcutaneous bortezomib, that neuropathy seems to be less of a problem with bortezomib than it used to be. Now, I'm still being referred patients from other places who are getting twice a week intravenous bortezomib, and I see that they're having a problem with neuropathy. But I think the issue of neuropathy in myeloma, I think, is becoming less. But in my patients with carfilzomib, I haven't seen it. So it's not just the trial data, it's also my own experience.
In terms of the use of bortezomib, you brought up weekly and subcutaneously. In what situations are you giving it weekly and subcutaneously?
Well, in almost every situation, our standard is to give it weekly and subcutaneously. We typically give it in combination with cyclophosphamide and dexamethasone.
What do we know, getting back to carfilzomib, about its safety in patients with renal dysfunction?
I don't think we know as much as we do about bortezomib. I think there's room for more data there. As far as I know, there's not a concern about it.
You talked about the combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. Of course, there's the RVD using bortezomib. But yet, I know at your place, and you just mentioned the CyBorD regimen is not infrequently utilized. How do you sort of weigh those two approaches?
Well, I think it's really complicated because all you really have to go on is response rate and side effect profiles. And with the data we have so far, I think they're equivalent. I don't think there's much to choose between them. And so then I think about the whole course of treatment of a patient. And if you think about a patient, a younger patient you're going to take to transplant, you're going to use induction, transplant, maybe consolidation, and maybe maintenance. I think it may be better to use lenalidomide later in the course of the disease and not necessarily up front. So do an induction with CyBorD, transplant, and then consider consolidation and or maintenance with lenalidomide.
When you do use consolidation and maintenance, for how long do you use it?
Well, it varies a lot based on the genetic risk factors for the patient. If the patient has high-risk genetics, I think the use of maintenance is important. And I think there, I think it's important to use bortezomib based on data from the HOVON study. And at the current time, we're combining that with lenalidomide, although there's basically no data for that. But that is what our practice has been at the Mayo Clinic. In the standard-risk patients, what I tend to do is give them 2 months of consolidation with lenalidomide, which is the way the patients were treated on IFM 2005 study. All patients got 2 months of consolidation. And then I have a discussion with them after the 2 months. They know what the side effects are like, and they can sort of make an informed decision as to whether they want to stay on it long term or just stop and take it again when the disease recurs.
Are there any other clinical decisions in myeloma that are changed in your mind because of cytogenetic risk, for example, induction treatment or in any situation, relapse disease?
For most of our younger patients that are going on to transplant, we like to use a proteasome inhibitor as part of the induction therapy because it's fast. And so if all the patients are receiving bortezomib, we think that influence of genetic risk factors is not so important. But for patients where you're not considering using bortezomib, either because they're older or because they're working and they can't come into your office so frequently and you're considering using lenalidomide and dexamethasone, I think that's a fine approach. but I would not do it in patients with high-risk genetics. So particularly the older gentlemen, I would tend to treat without bortezomib initially.
You know, thinking about the busy oncologist trying to keep a lot of pathways, markers, et cetera, in mind from a lot of different tumors, is there any way, I'm not going to say to simplify, but more maybe to summarize the key cytogenetic changes that get you to consider somebody in a higher risk situation?
Two big ones capture most of them. One is the 414 translocation, and the other one is 17p deletion. And 17p deletion is, you know, true across all cancers. That should be easy to remember. The 414 is specific for myeloma, but those two capture most. It's those I worry about.
Are there any other situations where you take that into consideration even farther down the line?
Well, I just mentioned about maintenance.
Right.
But then in general, you know, if I have a relapsing patient with one of those conditions, I think it's important, if you can, to include a proteasome inhibitor. I think the data of the use of IMIDs for those high-risk patients isn't very strong.
You mentioned the issue of post-transplant consolidation and maintenance. Does your approach to that change based on whether the patients had a complete response after the transplant?
The answer is no. If a patient has measurable disease post-transplant and this is standard risk patients and I give them 2 months of consolidation with lenalidomide, if I see what appears to be a dramatic response to that, I would continue the lenalidomide until I can't see any further response. But if there's no obvious difference or it's just a very, very minor difference and you can't really see anything, I would again have the discussion with the patient and talk to them about the pros and cons, but I wouldn't encourage them to do maintenance.
So we've been hearing about carfilzomib for a while and now it's here. What are you thinking in terms of how you might utilize this agent in non-protocol situations? And specifically, are there situations where you might consider, you mentioned the encouraging data that's been out there, would you consider it upfront?
The use of it upfront is really interesting. I would participate in a clinical trial of it eagerly, but I don't think I would do it yet because I would like to see a little bit more data about the safety profile in more patients. That was one concern about the approval of carfilzomib, was that there wasn't that much published experience about the side effects. And we've been burned in the past when we very rapidly move forward with drugs without having a better feeling. So until I get a little bit more experience, I wouldn't, unless I had a patient where they had neuropathy and I wanted to use a proteasome inhibitor, then I would do it when there was sort of a very clear reason why I wanted to do it, but not in most people.
There have been side effects discussed, like dyspnea. I haven't been quite clear about whether they really are associated with carfilzomib. Anything that you've observed or anything that you're looking for in terms of getting more data on?
Yeah, and I think maybe cardiac side effects, maybe fluid retention. And I think it may have been the patient population that I observed treated. They were sort of more relapsed refractory end-stage patients. And so I'd like to see a clinical trial performed in newly diagnosed patients that shouldn't have all these problems and just get a better feeling for some of those side effects.
Any thoughts about why proteasome inhibitors have been so effective in myeloma? It seems kind of like intuitively they're making a lot of protein. It's the garbage disposal for protein. Have you been able to get beyond that?
I guess I think it's multifactorial, but I think that it's such a characteristic of these cells that secrete antibody, you know, they're really just immunoglobulin factories and they have so much protein in them. And if you block the pathway that they use to deal with that, then it's toxic to the cell. So I think that's a lot of it. I think sometimes it's also NF-kappa-B, which was one of the first postulated mechanisms, that the activating mutations of NF-kappa-B occur in about a quarter of patients with multiple myeloma. And for those patients that may be extremely dependent on that pathway, it can be inhibited by bortezomib.
Any comments on oral proteasome inhibitors? We've seen some interesting data over the past year on MLN-9708.
MLN-9708 is already in the upfront setting in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. I think we maybe have some idea of their side effect profile, which I think might be a little bit worse than the side effect profile of bortezomib and carfilzomib, just GI toxicity and finding the right dose and schedule, I think, is still a challenge. And we don't really know about the efficacy. We don't know if they work as well. So I think we need more information.
Can you talk about what we know about pomalidomide and whether or not you think it's going to become available anytime in the near future?
Yeah. Pomalidomide is very closely related to thalidomide and lenalidomide. And both thalidomide and lenalidomide have unique features to their chemical structure. And pomalidomide has both those unique features in one drug. And whereas thalidomide we think is active in a 200 milligram dose range and lenalidomide in a 25 milligram dose range, then pomalidomide is active in a 2 to 3 milligram dose range. So it seems to be a more potent drug, and it is active, at least in combination with dexamethasone. And we have a number of patients who have progressed on either thalidomide or lenalidomide who've had long-term disease control with the use of pomalidomide. So there's no question in my mind that it's an active drug that really helps people. And I think the trick is to design the clinical trial that will convince regulators to approve the drug. And I think currently it's based on a study that's just completed that was performed primarily in Europe, although I think one site in the U.S., which was pomalidomide and dexamethasone versus a high-dose dexamethasone in relapsed refractory patients. And hopefully we'll have those results and the drug will be approved.
If it were approved, would you generally use it after lenalidomide?
No. I like the idea of alternating, depending on the situation, but alternating between an IMiD and a proteasome inhibitor. We had a recent manuscript in Blood where we described a patient with 414 myeloma who had multiple clones present. We followed her disease serially. And during the course of her disease, she had one clone that seemed to be sensitive to IMiDs and another clone sensitive to proteasome inhibitors. And as we use these drugs alternately, the clones came and went. So, you know, I would use cyclophosphamide and bortezomib, and when they relapse from that, lenalidomide and dexamethasone, and then go to carfilzomib and Doxil. I mean, just, I think, is a nice way to deal with patients.
So in oncology, we're always looking for predictors of response to treatment. And I was curious about your thoughts on the work coming out of your place headed by Keith Stewart on the use of Cereblon to predict benefit from IMiDs.
So yeah, there was a paper in Science by Japanese investigators that identified Cereblon as the mechanism of the teratogenicity of thalidomide. And Keith Stewart looked in myeloma and basically determined that Cereblon is the mechanism by which thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide are active in myeloma. And so, yes, patients who have low levels of Cereblon had a low response rate to lenalidomide. And in some new data he has, they also have very low response rate to pomalidomide. So it seems like we may have a predictive marker.
Interesting. Any comments on some of the things that have been developing over the last couple of years in terms of bone and myeloma? There was the big MRC UK study that came out, and just kind of curious, you know, how you're approaching the issue of bone-targeted therapy today compared to a few years ago.
Well, I guess the big issue, I think, is that we're seeing less osteonecrosis of the jaw. And that's, I believe, maybe because we're more aware of it, and also, I think, because dentists are also more aware of it. And so the concern about the use of zoledronic acid is less. I think the survival advantage that was seen with that agent in the MRC study is a fluke. I don't think it's likely to be reproducible. But I still think it's a good drug. So, you know, our standard practice is to put patients with bone disease on zoledronic acid for 2 years starting at diagnosis. And then after that, we stop it and resume it when they have evidence of recurrent bone disease.
It's funny, sometimes I'm about to ask a question, I go, oh, why should I ask this question? I've asked a whole bunch of people, they all say the same thing. But let me tell you something, nobody that I can remember turned around and said they thought it was a fluke. I think that's a very interesting comment. So you think it might have been
a chance,
you know, like some problem in terms of how the study was designed and executed?
No, I think it was
just random chance.
Random chance. I think if you look at the survival curves, the difference in mortality occurred all very early. And then the curves sort of were parallel after that. And it's hard to imagine what it was doing. I would guess it's chance.
Because there have been people, I think including some of your colleagues, who've talked to me about thinking about going beyond 2 years. I'm not sure they do, but it sounds like you don't.
No, I don't. We haven't had much discussion of it lately. And the discussion that we had about the zoledronic acid, there was general skepticism, I think, as to whether that would translate in other trials.
You know, in breast cancer, this is a big thing, too, with adjuvant bisphosphonates, and people seem like they just got tired of talking about it after a while.
Yeah.
I guess it's just like... Anyway, I wanted to go on to your cases, but before we do, just one other new agent I wanted to ask you about, because you've seen a lot of exciting things in a lot of diseases with monoclonal antibodies, but not too much until recently in myeloma. What about elotuzumab?
Yeah, there's two, elotuzumab and... daratumumab, I think, the anti-CD38 antibody. But
there's another one, anti-CD38?
Yeah, which I think looks even more promising. I'll tell you about elotuzumab first. So it's an antibody to CS1, which doesn't show any single agent activity in the clinical trial. But when it was examined in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in the relapse setting, looked promising, and has been examined in the upfront setting with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, and again had a surprisingly high response rate in that setting, higher than what you'd expect with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, generating excitement for that concept. And yeah, I think it would be great if we can find a monoclonal antibody for this disease. And I think that's clearly one of the most exciting ones. The other agent I just mentioned, the anti-CD38 antibody daratumumab, does seem to have single agent activity that was presented at ASCO this year. They still haven't reached the dose limiting toxicity, but at the higher doses of the antibody, they saw partial responses and as well as minor responses in a relapse refractory setting. And so I think that drug is, I guess I would say it's more exciting because it seems to have single agent activity.
Let's talk about your patients, beginning with your 55-year-old woman who comes in with symptomatic myeloma, anemia, lytic bone disease, ISS stage 1, FISH demonstrates hyperdiploidy, 4 cycles of RD with a PR, referred for stem cell collection and transplant. The referring physician wants to switch to a bortezomib-containing regimen to obtain a deeper response prior to collection, but you recommend collection and transplant without additional induction therapy and no plans for maintenance.
Right. Typical good prognosis young patient. And there was a recent study from the French that looked at people just like her, so under the age of 55 with no adverse genetic features and I think a normal beta-2 microglobulin. And the 10-year survival for that woman, if she'd been treated in 1999, is 75%. And so obviously now we're talking about 2012 with all these new drugs. She has an excellent long-term survival. And I think the last thing that I'd want to do is to give her a debilitating neuropathy that she would have for the rest of her life when there's not any data that that's needed. Now you could say, well, responders do better than non-responders. And so if you get a better response before transplant, she'll do better. But there's really very little data to support that. If you look at the studies that have been done, response before transplant, there was Thal-Dex versus Dex, or bortezomib dexamethasone versus VAD done by the French. It was 3 times the complete response rate with bortezomib dexamethasone before transplant, but no difference in progression-free survival or overall survival. So in a setting like that, I would not want to give her the toxicity, and I would go ahead with the transplant. And I think based on the data we have, she's going to do exceptionally well. And I would not want to give her the risk of second malignancies from lenalidomide maintenance. And I would just follow her closely. And when and if the disease recurs, treat her at that point.
So, you know, our group likes to take case situations like this and ask 25 or 50 investigators or docs in practice what they would do. And I'm curious, what do you think if we were to ask 25 clinical investigators what kind of induction they would use for this 55-year-old woman, what kind of answers do you think we would get?
I think most clinical investigators would probably choose a proteasome inhibitor as part of the induction. And I think I mentioned that I typically would as well. In this case, a patient like this was referred to me. This actually was a story. This patient was referred to me.
Would you specifically have likely used, for example, Cyborg-D up front in a patient like this?
Yeah, no, I would have used Cyborg-D in a patient like this.
But I guess the difference here is the patient had gotten to you. By the time they got to you, they had the RD and had a response, and that was why you didn't want to bring in a bortezomib.
That's right.
Interesting.
It comes up a lot, whether you should adjust your induction based on the response. Should you do a response-adapted approach?
Right.
And I think that there's another case that we'll get to it, because I think it is maybe different for high-risk disease, but not for standard risk.
So another aspect to this case actually is the recommendation for a transplant. I think that maybe a few years ago I was seeing maybe some ambivalence about transplant and investigators. And then I think I saw in the last year shift back towards transplant. Obviously, there's trials out there trying to determine whether transplant needs to be done or it could be delayed. What are your thinking in terms of, for example, in this kind of situation, moving forward as opposed to just collecting cells and waiting?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. You get a better quality of life with the upfront transplant. We know if we just stay with lenalidomide, the patient could stay on it for about 3 to 4 years and then would progress and then would need to go get other therapy. I think the survival is probably the same with early versus late transplant based on what we know now. I think you've got a longer time disease-free with better quality of life with the upfront transplant.
Before we go into the next case, I'm just kind of curious on the other side of the coin, the older patient who's not a transplant candidate, let's say 75, 80 years old, few comorbidities. We can, you know, debate what it takes to be a transplant candidate, but let's just assume the patient's not going to be a transplant candidate. What's your strategy for upfront treatment in patients like this in general and for ongoing treatment?
So for a good risk hyperdiploid patient like that, I think lenalidomide and dexamethasone would be an excellent choice. And I would put them on that. And I would tend to keep them on that for 2 years, probably not until disease progression, if they haven't progressed in that time, and then stop therapy and follow them off therapy at that point. And stopping the dexamethasone 6 to 12 months.
And again, in a situation where they have adverse cytogenetics, but still 75, 80 years old, how would you be thinking that through?
Right, so then I think you need a proteasome inhibitor. We would typically use Cyborg-D because I think we have got so much familiarity with it and we find it's very easy to give. I think melphalan prednisone and bortezomib would be good, but it's not something I've used very much.
What about the issue of preemptive dose reduction in the older patient? Antonio Palumbo and others have talked about this or tables out there. How do you approach that question?
Yeah, I think with lenalidomide, it's probably a good idea, especially when you get to be quite elderly, late 80s, 90s. I wouldn't start with the full dose. With bortezomib subcutaneously weekly, I haven't seen the need for it. But then again, I'm not treating that many elderly patients with, I'm only treating the high risk with the bortezomib.
Let's talk about your 68-year-old man. You say here he was diagnosed with symptomatic myeloma in 2003, treated with high-dose dex, followed by stem cell transplant. Relapsed in 2011 with lytic bone lesion, then right humerus and left femur. Again, I don't know if this is somebody actually you were thinking about specifically. Has a VGPR to two cycles of RVD, but discontinues the bortezomib because of neuropathy. Placed in RD maintenance, and you advised him to stop the RD and go to a second stem cell transplant. Any thoughts about this?
There is actually a patient like that, but actually he had stored stem cells. And a lot of patients I'm seeing like that actually still have stored stem cells. They collected enough for two transplants back, and you don't always need to attempt the stem cell collection. But I have had patients where I have attempted the stem cell collection in this setting, and it's been successful, although it did require the use of the Mosabil. So I think people, kind of as you were saying, there was a trend maybe to sort of downplay transplant or not use transplant as much. But when you have patients like that that have had such a long disease-free interval or progression-free survival after the first transplant, I think it's a great therapy, and you should do everything you can to give it to them again while you still can.
How about your 62-year-old man, symptomatic myeloma, anemia, ISS stage 3, FISH deletion 17P, gets four cycles of Cyborg-D with a PR, referred for stem cell collection and transplant, but you recommend additional induction with four cycles of VRD.
Yeah, so that, I guess, gets to the point about the response-adapted therapy. I think in someone with high risk, and I think maybe in particular with a 17P deleted patients who do so poorly, I think the idea of getting a maximal response before exposing them to the high-dose melphalan is a good thing. And this is based mostly on data from Dr. Barlogi, who showed that response was important there. And so in that setting, I think to try and bring in lenalidomide and get a maximal response before giving the melphalan. The melphalan is a DNA damaging agent, and this, in general, the high-risk patients seem to have some genomic instability. And I think the smaller the clone is when it gets exposed to the melphalan, the less chance of you doing harm or selecting for very resistant clones. And so that's a situation where I would go for a response before transplant. And I don't say it there, but then after transplant, I would recommend bortezomib-based maintenance for 2 years.